Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by the OU Israel Center in Yerushalayim. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Shabbat Parshat Teruma, but it is taking place or being first recorded on the 2nd of the merry month of Adar, and that's why the beginning was a little different from usual. We arranged for the Westminster chimes of Big Ben to delay from 5 o'clock when the news went on until the start of the show, so we appreciate that gesture, and I don't think they will soon repeat that, because they've been getting calls from all over the world about being a little bit late, but as I said, I acknowledge and I appreciate the gesture of allowing us to start our first Adar show this year with the 5 o'clock chimes from Westminster Tower, or whatever it happens to be called. Following the chimes of 5, we heard one of the Mishanichnas Adar songs from a wonderful Noam Productions album called Greatest Purim Hits with Avrami Flam. Mishanichnas Adar, hopefully you'll hear another one later in the show. Regular listeners know that I had lost my voice last week, and the show, well, maybe you don't know, but it was pieced together by me, edited from two different shows of last year, to be able to get Parshat Mishpatim and Shkalim as content of the show, and my voice is not 100%, but I'm back, and good to be back. We will hear a large piece of a shiur I gave the Torah Tidbits folders earlier today on Parshat Truma. We'll have time for some music and a few other comments about this week's Sedra, but let us begin in our traditional style with Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed. Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Karaticha Adonai. Adonai Shimavakoli Tehiyena Oznecha Kashuvot Lekol Tachanunai. Ima Vonot Tishmorya Adonai Mia Amod Ki Imacha Haslicha Lema'an Tivarei. Kiviti Adonai Kiveta Nafshi Velidvaro Hocholti. Nafshi Ladonai Mishomerim Laboker Shomerim Laboker. Yachel Yisrael El Adonai Ki Im Adonai HaChesed V'harbe Imo Fedut V'hu Yifde Et Yisrael Mikol Avonotav. Achenu Kol Beit Yisrael Hanetunim Batzara V'Shevya Ha'omedim Bein Bayam U'Vein Bayabasha Hamakom Yirachem Aleihem V'yotzieim Mitzara L'Yirvacha U'Me'afela L'Ora U'Mishibud L'Geula Hashta Ba'Agala U'Vizman Kariv V'Nomar Amen. Before we turn to Parshat Truma and the recording I made earlier today for the Torah Tidbits folders, I want to make a comment about Mishanichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha. As Adar enters, we increase in joy. Rashi, in a commentary someplace in the Talmud, says that part of the reason for the joy of Adar is the fact that it is followed by Nisan with Pesach. In other words, we should not look just at Purim, but the fact that our sages coordinated the calendar, so to speak, so that the month of Purim is followed by the month of Pesach, so that the Geula, redemption of Purim, is followed by the story of the redemption of Pesach, and that combined we also look forward to the complete redemption of the future, and those memories and thoughts combine to make this a very joyous month. And I must add that it's joyous in spite of ourselves. In other words, sometimes it's hard to be joyous when certain things are happening in the world, and especially here in Israel. And yet, it's as if God knows that. And b'chol zot, in any event, he is saying, Mishanichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha. I'm not claiming that that's a quote from the Torah, so don't take that literally. But there definitely is a complex emotional fact of Jewish life, that our joy and our sadness and our apprehension are all rolled into one. Rather than being contradictory emotions, they are complementary and simultaneous expressions of a complex body of emotions. And let's leave it at that for now. Mishenichnas Adar Marbim Besimcha. If you don't feel it yet, work on it. It's worthwhile. As I've told you all before, I need to record a show for Arut Sheva on the OU website. And I have a deadline coming. I'd like to give you a shiur, and I can't do both at the same time, except I can do both at the same time. So that's what I'm doing. And the only thing that makes it a little different is that I'm wearing a headset. I actually tried with a less conspicuous microphone, but it didn't work as well. In any event, let me start. It's almost like old territory, but I feel that every year when we come up to Parshat Truma and we talk about Mishkan, it needs to be reopened and re-said. Let me start it this way. There's a famous story about a sea captain, his wife, and his little boy. The sea captain was away from home for many, many weeks at a time, sometimes months, came back for a short visit with his wife and child, and then went back to sea. The mother, wife, was concerned that the child shouldn't forget his father. So she had this picture of this dashing fellow on his ship, nicely framed, sitting next to the boy's bed. Every night when she would go in to tell him a bedtime story, sing him a lullaby, part of it would be telling him about his father. And before the boy went to sleep, he would take the picture in his hand and he would kiss his father's picture and then go to sleep. After months at sea, the father came home for a visit. Wife and child were very happy. Father went in to take care of the putting the kid to sleep this time, told him some nice stories, sang him a song, said his Shema with him, and just before the boy was about to go to sleep, he took the picture of his father and he kissed it and went to sleep. Now, I've always thought that's a cute, charming story with a very important message. I remember first trip I made to Israel was as a young lad in 1962, summer 62. That's before 67, after 48, which means the Kotel was not in Israeli hands. And I remember going up onto Har Tzion and having a guide point. You see those red-roofed buildings over there? Look at the one on the right, has an antenna. A little bit to the left of that and further back, that's where the Kotel is. So we went to Har Tzion on Leil Tisha B'Av, and it was that experience plus going behind the King David Hotel to the barbed wire facing out over no man's land and seeing the walls of the old city, going to the Mandelbaum Gate and looking across the checkpoint to the Jordanian side. And all of those things were done out of a longing for something which was not accessible. Came 67. I didn't get back until 69. But I remember my preparation for the first visit, my first visit to the Kotel. And I remember that the feeling that when the situation is such where you can't go to the Kotel itself, then imagining it, having a poster in your bedroom, and all the other things that you feel and think about and say are okay. When you can go, then how can you not go? And I remember that very, I was going to say heavy feeling, it was a momentous feeling of finally getting to that place. Then I remember a subsequent visit where I wanted more, and I couldn't have more. So I remember my wife, my brother, and I think it was summer 73, we went down the street of the chain to the gate to Har HaBayit, and we stood there looking through the open gate, seeing the Temple Mount. At the time, I was totally convinced that the line, quote, "a Jew is not allowed to go anywhere there," was accurate. I subsequently learned better. But at the time, it was a forbidden place to go. It was permitted to see, and I wanted to see more than I could from standing at the Kotel. Side point, just a story I've told before. While my brother, wife, and I are standing looking through that gate, along comes three American tourists, a guy named Harry, Bermuda shorts and socks and sandals, and his wife and her sister. The two women were not properly dressed as far as the Muslims were concerned to allow them onto the Temple Mount. And while they were putting on whatever garments the Muslim guards gave them, Harry wandered over to us. And he saw my kippah and he said to me, you're not going there because you're religious, right? Yeah. Oh, no, he didn't say it like that. He said, "You're not going there because you're a Kohen?" I said, "No, actually, I'm not going there because I'm Jewish." So he said, "What do you mean? I'm Jewish too." So I quickly explained to him about Tumat Meit and Har HaBayit and the Beit HaMikdash and the Kedusha. Just as I finished the explanation, his wife said, "Come on, Harry, we're ready." They were on their way to the Dome of the Rock. I saw a line of sweat pop out of his forehead. And he turns to his wife and feebly says, but they said that we're not allowed to go. So she gives him one of these looks saying, "Harry, are you coming or not?" So he looks at her and he looks at us and he said, "I could see it fine from here." So we got him. So while his wife and her sister went into the Dome of the Rock, Harry stayed with us. I felt obligated to give him a little chizuk, you know, kol hakavod, that he was staying with us. Now, I would love to tell you the end of the story is he became religious and went to yeshiva and now is a Rosh Yeshiva someplace. I don't know what happened to Harry or his wife or her. But the point was, we were standing there as close at the time that I thought you can possibly be to that holy place of the Beit HaMikdash. And therefore, it wasn't satisfactory anymore to look at it from a distance or to imagine it from a distance. Remember in your mind that little boy, in the presence of his own living father, turns to a picture of the father and kisses the picture. Because for so long, that representation became his father, and the existence of his father in the room didn't alert him, didn't catch him that things are now different. A lot of people see the Kotel, which is a remnant of the retaining wall of Har HaBayit, which when you stand at the Kotel and face forward, you are not facing the place of the Mikdash, that you would have to turn heavily to the left in order to be facing Mekom HaMikdash. I'll tell you another thing that I heard, which feeds part of my point. A guy asked the following shaila: when you're on Har HaBayit and you happen to be standing between the Kotel and the place of the Beit HaMikdash, if you were to daven Shmona Esrei, which way should you face? Which is an unbelievably ridiculous and sad question, because one, when one is outside of Eretz Yisrael, he davens facing Eretz Yisrael. When you're in Eretz Yisrael, you daven facing Jerusalem. When you're in Jerusalem, you face Har HaBayit. when you're on Har HaBayit, you face the place of the Mikdash. The Kotel became that picture of the father, sea captain, that the boy had, became a replacement for Har HaBayit and for Mikom HaMikdash, and unfortunately, for the Beit HaMikdash itself. It's almost as we have the Kotel, who needs the Beit HaMikdash? And that's the problem. One of the three mitzvot out of 613 from Parsha Truma is V'asuli Mikdash V'shachanti B'tocham, build a sanctuary. That mitzvah was fulfilled by Moshe Rabbeinu in his generation, subsequently by Shlomo HaMelech, subsequently by Ezra and the returnees to Eretz Yisrael, and it is still an open mitzvah in the Torah to fulfill. The Torah is very clear, really, the sources on Torah, from Torah Sheba'al Peh, are very clear that anything that is not in perpetuity is not counted as a mitzvah. God commanded Noah to build an ark that does not find itself on anybody's list of 613 mitzvot. It was a command, and God commanded Noah, but it was a one-shot deal. One-shot deals don't get on to the list of mitzvot. V'asuli mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham has not run its course. We still have yet to build the Beit HaMikdash. You could argue also that even with a standing Beit HaMikdash, there are elements of the mitzvah that continue. But what I'm saying is that we have gone so long without a Beit HaMikdash that we have learned to live as Jews comfortably, saying, Yehi Ratzon, may it be God's will, Sheyabana Beit HaMikdash b'mehera v'yameinu, that the temple should be rebuilt speedily in our time, v'sham na'avodcha b'yira, and there we will serve you with reverence, etc., etc. And we say it as if that's the ultimate. The ultimate is really the abolishment of that prayer, when that prayer becomes totally irrelevant because the Beit HaMikdash will be here. Until it's here, we say three times a day, four times on Shabbat, five times on Yom Kippur, Yehi Ratzon Sheyibana Beit HaMikdash. Chazonim sing it at concerts, and everybody knows different tunes to it. And in Sur Mishalo's Mira, you have Yibana, Yibana HaMikdash. All of these things are the picture of the sea captain father that the kid kisses each night. But until, and only until, the father comes home, until the Beit HaMikdash is rebuilt. And I think for a combination of reasons, one of which is a natural defense mechanism, and I say this, I've said it before, I think the Jewish people as a community, and each individual Jew in different ways, over the centuries, has learned so well to cope without the Beit HaMikdash that it almost is not a real factor in the Jews' day-to-day life. If it were, we would be crying all the time. You know, this brings to mind an interesting discussion about meat during the days before Tisha B'Av. The halacha says that on the meal preceding Tisha B'Av, if it's during the week, you're not allowed to eat meat or drink wine. The minhag, the minhag developed that during the whole week in which Tisha B'Av falls, you don't eat meat or drink wine except for Shabbat. The minhag in the Ashkenazi communities went a little further, and from Rosh Chodesh Av until Tisha B'Av, except for Shabbat, we don't eat meat or drink wine, which is a zecher l'churban Beit HaMikdash. meat and wine not only are symbols of simcha, which is not appropriate during the mourning of the Beit HaMikdash, but it's also symbols of the Beit HaMikdash itself because of the korbanot and the wine that was used as part of the service. Okay, a further minhag is not to eat meat or drink wine after Tisha B'Av until the next Shabbat. The Shabbat after Tisha B'Av is called Shabbat Nachamu, and even though you're allowed to eat meat starting in the noon of the day after Tisha B'Av, but some people develop the custom to wait until Shabbat Nachamu before they have meat. Now what's discussed in the Sfarim is the following. There were people who said, meat, wine, how could we eat meat and drink wine when we don't have a Beit HaMikdash? A big jump now, although not such a big jump if you think about it. If the average person abstains from meat for a period of 9 days or 10 or 11 or 12 days, whatever the case may be, out of deference to the commemoration of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, there are people, let me fill in one point so it's not such a big jump, there are different halachot and minhagim about zecher l'churban throughout the year. In other words, it is not only during the week of Tisha B'Av or the 9 day period or even the 3 week period that we mourn its destruction. It's always the minhag of leaving a square unfinished near your door, or the minhag of not of not setting the table with your finest, but always leaving something lacking from the table, is a sign of Zecher L'Churban, and there are prayers and there are different customs that go throughout the year. Now it's no longer a big jump to say, I'm not saying this for myself, but there are people who have suggested, maybe except for Shabbat and Yom Tov, we shouldn't have meat at all during the week. We shouldn't drink wine at all during the week, Zecher L'Churban. So the halacha books bring down a discussion in the Gemara where someone said, I think we shouldn't have meat or wine at all until a Beit HaMikdash. So another person says to him, maybe we shouldn't have bread with flour because wheat flour was used in the Beit HaMikdash for the Lechem HaPanim and the Menachot offerings, and it wouldn't be appropriate without a Beit HaMikdash. To which the answer was, maybe. And how about fruit? We shouldn't have any fruit because fruit were used for Bikurim in the Beit HaMikdash. And maybe we shouldn't have water because there was Nisuch HaMayim in the Beit HaMikdash. Now, these questions were not serious questions. They were responses to the suggestion of not having meat by saying, that's a little ridiculous. We have our commemorations, we have our reminders, but you don't go overboard. Because if you do, look at what you're going to stop. You're going to stop everything because of an association with the Beit HaMikdash. Don't light your homes with oil lamps because they were in the Beit HaMikdash. We don't say any of those things. I bring them up because the the need of the Jew to function as a Jew, not just as a person, required him to ease up on this Beit HaMikdash, let's have it back thing, because until it comes back, it's constantly frustrating not to have it. So if you're able to carry on with your Jewish life and build into it the reminders of prayers that you say, and every morning in the Korbanot section, you have a reading about Korban X, Y, or Z, and you have a statement after it. Let my recitation be Ki'ilu, as if I brought this Korban. We turn to God, and the language is very, very clear. excuse me again, we turn to God and we say, I shouldn't be just saying these words. I should be out there doing these korbanot. But you don't let me. You took away the Beit HaMikdash, which is sort of not a fair way to say it. We don't have a Beit HaMikdash anymore, and therefore, almost chutzpahdikly, we insist that he accept our recitations because we don't have the Beit HaMikdash in order to actually do the korbanot. Now there's another thing, which is different, but I think it's part of what I'm trying to get at. Rambam, in Hilchot Teshuvah, speaks about the atoning features of certain korbanot in the Beit HaMikdash, of the Sa'ir Lazazel, the scapegoat of Yom Kippur service, and then says, but in our time, when we don't have a Beit HaMikdash, and we don't have an atoning altar, and we don't have Kohanim doing their function in the Beit HaMikdash, we only have repentance. And tshuva will take care of everything if it's done properly, because otherwise we would really be up the creek without a paddle. And he doesn't use exactly that image, but he says words to that effect. And here's what he doesn't say, but I believe is in the back of people's minds. You open up the Tanakh, and you see how how the Jewish people behaved during the time of the First Temple. You hear how the Nevi'im castigated the people in God's name, saying, what, you think bringing korbanot is what's going to do the job when you behave immorally and you do this and you do that? And by that repeated prophetic message, we sort of developed a subconscious idea. I'm saying we, I mean I, and I'm trying to purge it from myself also. We develop a certain subconscious idea that if you have a Beit HaMikdash, look at all the problems that you have. What's better is if you can be an honest, ethical, God-fearing, Torah-observant person, and then that's better than having a Beit HaMikdash and not treating it properly, or having a Beit HaMikdash and thinking you don't have to behave ethically because the hocus-pocus of Beit HaMikdash service will atone for things, which it doesn't. Rambam and others are very clear that a korban that was meant to atone is totally wasted if a person doesn't do tshuva at the same time. But it doesn't change the perception of, for so much time of the tenure of the Mishkan and the Beit HaMikdash, we hear reports of people in Tanakh who worshipped idols, who turned away from God, who equivocated and said, I believe in God, but I believe that he's too remote to take care of everyday life, and therefore I also believe in this God or that God, which is part of Avodah Zarah as well. And we feel sometimes, consciously or subconsciously, that we have outgrown the negative parts of those stories, and we've done well, and it's really not fair to say we do not fall to the temptation of Avodah Zarah like the ancestors did, because we don't have those temptations. We have other temptations, and we fall to those. But we sometimes make a comparison. Beit HaMikdash with hollow practices, or no Beit HaMikdash with sincere behavior, which do you prefer? Wrong question. Wrong question. Because that question has to be answered by saying, between those two choices, I prefer the Beit HaMikdash not to be here when the people can keep the Torah. That would be preferable to a Beit HaMikdash with people worshiping idols. But that's not a fair question. The question is, Beit HaMikdash and finally learning how to behave as an individual Jew and as a Jewish community with a Beit HaMikdash without God having to say to us, you guys are missing the point. We should have gotten the point by now. I made a calculation last year that from the moment we came out of Egypt until today, we have been without a Beit HaMikdash over 550 years longer than when we had one. Adding up the Mishkans and the Shiloh thing and everything else, plus the first and the second Beit HaMikdash, and even counting the times in between, if you give that whole block of time to, yes, Beit HaMikdash, and since the destruction of the second one without, we have outdone in time how much of the existence so far of Am Yisrael with a Beit HaMikdash or without a Beit HaMikdash. And again I say, I believe it's subconscious that people feel, well, if that's the case, and you look at the Tanakh, and you look at what happened, and the track record, and everything like that, then really, I'll say my Sheyabana Beit HaMikdash, I'll sing Yibana HaMikdash on Friday night, and I will have a picture of Har HaBayit and the Beit HaMikdash, and I'll talk about it, I'll learn about it, I'll recite things about it, but maybe that's enough. And the answer is, it's not enough. V'asu li mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham is not a figurative command, it's a real, actual command. I heard someone say that, well, it means building a sanctuary to God in your heart. As the song, Bilavavi Mishkan Evne, I will build a Mishkan in my heart. Very nice idea, very important concept, and it fits. V'asu li mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham, I will dwell among them, the Jewish people, individually or collectively, and or collectively, but it should not be to the exclusion of an actual, real, physical Beit HaMikdash on Har HaBayit in Yerushalayim, with Kohanim doing Avoda, with modern technology helping wherever it's halachically be allowed to. You know, people think of Beit HaMikdash automatically, they think of old-fashioned, primitive, has to go back to that. It doesn't. There are things, and each new technology will be questioned. Can we use this in the Beit HaMikdash? Can we? Can a Kohen, when he does Avodah in the Beit HaMikdash, wear shoes or socks? No. But can the floor of the Beit HaMikdash be suffused with a heating system so that Kohanim won't catch cold when they walk barefoot in the winter? 100% yes. In fact, that's not even a good example because it was something like that in the past. Some system of hot water going through pipes. But today you could do it electricity or whatever and it'll be done. Anyway, don't have more time for that, but we should not think that we have outgrown the idea of a Beit HaMikdash just because we've managed to cope so long without it, any more than that little boy has to realize that when his father comes home, and especially when it's not a one-night visit, but his father comes home and he's retired from the sea, and he's going to be living at home now, that the boy has to make a good transition from kissing the picture of his father to hugging and kissing his real living father. And I think we have to do that in our minds, and I see it in little things also. I've said this before as well. You daven on Yom Tov. Yom Tov is a day of joy, a mitzvah in the Torah to have simcha. Yet, when we daven Musaf, the first words of the Musaf section, Umipnei chataenu ga'alinu me'artzenu, because of our sins, we were exiled from our land, and we can't do this anymore, and we are missing this, and Emir Tzashem will be able to do it again. That is a melancholy kind of thought on a day that essentially is supposed to be joyous, but it needs to be there in proper perspective. You should not go through Yom Tov, woe unto us that we don't have a Beit HaMikdash, because that's not what Yom Tov is supposed to be. Yom Tov has a form and an existence with a Beit HaMikdash and without a Beit HaMikdash. And we have to have a well-proportioned reminder of the Yom Tov in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, as well as a healthy attitude towards joy in Yom Tov as well. That's some of my thoughts for Parshat Terumah, as we see the command again each year to build the Beit HaMikdash.
There's still more to say, but let's go back to the Noam Productions album, have a listen to their other Misha Nichnas Adar, and then we'll wrap things up.
Misha Nichnas Adar Marve Besimcha. Misha Nichnas Adar Marve Besimcha.
First of all, last week was Parshat Shkalim. Next Shabbat is Parshat Zachor. And this Shabbat is the Shabbat between Parshat Zachor and Parshat Shkalim. Shkalim and Zachor. There is not always a Shabbat between the two. When there is, it is known as a Hafsaka, a break in the flow of our Arba Parshiot. Whether or not there is a break simply depends on the way the calendar is constructed, with Shkalim, the Shabbat of or before Rosh Chodesh Adar, and Zohar, the Shabbat before Purim. You look at a calendar and you could see the numbers yourselves. Sometimes you need that extra week in between, mostly, and once in a while we don't, and there will be this hafsaka or not. So as far as the cycle of the parshiot, we're in a break, but it does have a significance because there is an important bridge between Shkalim of last week and Zachor of next week. I think I mentioned this last week, except that I wasn't speaking last week, so I will say it again. One of the explanations, a very beautiful explanation, to the connection between Shkalim and Zachor, and specifically that Shkalim precedes Zachor, is that the mitzvah of our giving the half shekel was like a vaccination, an antidote to the poison of Amalek, its descendants Haman and family, and specifically to the record in Megillat Esther that Haman, when he went to Ahasuerus to ask for permission to launch pogroms to kill the Jews of Ahasuerus's kingdom, one of the things he said to him was, if you will give us permission to do this, we will bring to the royal coffers the sum of 10,000 talents of silver. In other words, a lot of money to you, Ahasuerus, in consideration for your permission to us to kill the Jews. Now, it turns out that 10,000 talents, the talent coin, kikar, is equal to 30 silver shekels, means that the total amount Haman offered Ahasuerus to kill the Jews was 300,000 shekelim, which is 600,000 half shekels, and 600,000 is that symbolic number representing Bnei Yisrael. And what do we go ahead and do on the Shabbat before, or two Shabbatot before Parshat Zachor, when we remember Amalek and get into the Purim story? We read about Shkalim, because well before Haman offered that many Shkalim to destroy us, we were commanded to take as kofer nefesh, an atonement for the soul, the amount of 1/2 silver shekel, and give it to the Beit HaMikdash, and it becomes a life force for us. So it is spoken of in the sources as putting the cure before the reference to the illness. The other idea, I think, is equally potent. The other thing that Haman said before Ahasuerus is, it doesn't pay to let these people live, and you don't have to worry about them rebelling, because they are scattered throughout your kingdom. They're not unified. The concept of giving a half shekel is to plug every Jew into Klal Yisrael as a unified entity. And that makes the Shkalim, the mitzvah of Shkalim, a very powerful antidote and vaccine against the Hamans of the world. Okay, let's listen now to one more track from Greatest Purim Hits with Avrami Flam. This one is called V'Nahafochu. It's a new version of that song, Words from the Megillah. And it's true that the Megillah speaks of the 13th of Adar as being a day that V'Nahafochu, things looked bad, but it turned out good. But the Megillah also refers to the month of Adar, as in the pasuk in the Megillah, Kayamim asher nachu vahem hayehudim me'oyvehem, just like the days that the Jews rested from their enemies, v'hachodesh, and the month, asher nehpach lahem miyagon l'simcha, u'me'evel yom tov lasot otam yemei mishteh v'simcha, etc., etc. So the month of Adar is described in the Megillah, not just the date of Purim or pre-Purim, but the month of Adar is associated with the concept of a reversal, a v'nahafochu, or nehpach. That's a nun with a hey, which has a shva nach under it, so you have to aspirate it a little, nehpach. It's a hard word to say, but it makes the song V'Nahafochu not just a Purim song, but an Adar song as well, and therefore joining the other two tracks of Mishanechnas Adar, we will now hear V'Nahafochu. Let me share with you now a couple of Divrei Torah, or, hey, let's call them Torah tidbits for Parshat Terumah to finish up the show. You've got the famous verse towards the beginning of the Parsha, V'asu li mikdash v'shachanti betocham, and they, referring to Bnei Yisrael, God is talking to Moshe and telling him to speak to the people of Israel, they shall make a sanctuary for me, and I will dwell, says God, betocham, in them. So, of course, the commentaries say, notice It's a little different from what you might expect the verse to say. The simple expectation would be, they shall make a sanctuary for me, and I will dwell in it. But it doesn't say that, it says betocham, and of course the commentaries teach us that God is not being restricted to the physical boundaries of a sanctuary which we build for him, but by this community endeavor of building the Mikdash, it goes towards bringing God's divine presence among us, bitocham. If that in any way can be seen as vague, with the necessity of drash, analyzing the wording in the pasuk in order to say that, then the Haftarah, which comes from the book of Malachim Aleph, clears it up, as if it needed clearing up. The last verse in this week's Haftarah, Vishachanti betoch b'nei Yisrael, I will dwell among or in the community of Israel, v'lo e'ezov et ami Yisrael, and I will never abandon the people, my people, Israel. This follows Vayehi Devar Hashem El Shlomo Lemor. This is the words of God to Shlomo. Habayit Hazeh Asher Atavoneh. This house which you are building, first Beit HaMikdash. Im Telech Bechukotai. If you will follow my laws. Ve'et Mishpatai Ta'aseh. And do my statutes. Vishamarta et kol mitzvotai, and keep all of my commandments, lalechet bohem, to follow them and to go in their ways, v'hakimoti et divari itach asher dibarti el David avicha, I will fulfill the promises that I made to your father David, and then v'shachanti betoch b'nei Yisrael, I will dwell among the people of Israel. So it makes for no need to have a drash on Vishachanti betocham, as opposed to betocho, very clearly spelled out. And if you want to go back to the Torah, you look in next week's Parsha, towards the end of the Melechet HaMishkan, as was started in Truma, but continues, and it really continues beyond, you have it spelled out very clearly as well. I referred to verse 46, 45 of chapter 29, Vishachanti betoch b'nei Yisrael, v'hayiti lahem lelokim. I will dwell among the people of Israel, and I will be their God. This is the package deal we have in the command to build a mikdash. Next, on a technical issue of counting of the mitzvot, I mentioned, I think, that there are three mitzvot in Parshat Teruma. One is the mitzvah to build the mikdash, the mishkan, slash sanctuary, with everything in it. The individual furnishings which we are commanded to fashion are not counted as separate mitzvot, not by the Rambam at least. For example, Va'asu Aron Atzei Shitim, make a box out of wood. These are its dimensions. Vitzipita oto zahav tahor. You shall plate it with pure gold, inside and outside. Also a command, but considered a detail. Viatzakta lo, and you weld onto it four gold rings, and you fashion carrying poles, and you make them from wood, and you plate them with gold, and you put them into the rings. All of those are details that are not counted as separate commands, but are included, as the Rambam puts it, in the all-encompassing command of the Osuli Mikdash. However, when we come now to Bitab'ot Ha'aron Yihyu Habadim, in the rings of the Ark, the holy Aron, you shall have the carrying poles. It says there, Lo Yasuru Mimenu, they shall not be removed therefrom. That prohibition of removing the poles the carrying poles from their rings, is counted as a separate command. Possibly because it's a prohibition, and the Osuli Mikdash is a mitzvat aseh, a positive command. Then there is one other detail, which we don't consider to be a detail of the fashioning of the Mikdash and everything in it. It's a subsequent kind of command, that the shulchan, the special table, gold-plated wood and shelves and poles and everything like that, the command is to place the lechem hapanim, the showbread, on the shelves of the shulchan, and they be there always. They were replaced once a week, but once the shulchan was inaugurated with the first set of lechem hapanim, the lechem hapanim were to remain there in perpetuity. Again, I say, replaced one week by the next, but never off, never uncovered shelves thereafter. That too is counted as a separate mitzvah among the 613. Speaking of the lechem hapanim, I wanted to present something. I've said it before, but this is one of the sedras that it fits. Over Shabbat, if you have an opportunity to sing Zmirot, then one of the ones you should choose, my recommendation, is Kiyesh Merah Shabbat. And on one of the stanzas in Kiyesh Merah Shabbat, you have an appropriate to Parshat Truma comment to make, to tell your family and your guests. What do we say? Rasham Bidat Hakel. It is written in the Torah. Dat Hakel is the Torah. Chok El Siganav, a law for Kohanim. Kohanim are called God's deputies. Bo La'aroch Lechem Panim Bifanav. In the Beit HaMikdash, in the Mikdash, in the Mishkan, you have to set out the Lechem HaPanim before God, so to speak. Al Kain, therefore, Lehit Anot Bo, to fast on Shabbat, Al pi nivonav asur. According to our sages, there is a rabbinic prohibition against fasting on Shabbat. Levad miyom kippur avoni, except of course for Yom Kippur when it falls on Shabbat. Now, what I would like to extend or explain this is as follows. If eating on Shabbat would be the mere fulfillment of human needs, and Shabbat's spiritual quest would be a totally separate endeavor of Shabbat, then the Shabbat would be a combination of spiritual pursuits as well as practical human behavior, but the two might not blend to become a joint partnership in the way that we honor the Shabbat. However, because God commanded in the Beit HaMikdash that there be special breads to honor the Shabbat and to honor the Beit HaMikdash, then God was raising the stakes, so to speak, pun intended, raising the limit of the participation of food in the spiritual process that is Shabbat and that is Jewish life in general. In other words, because it is Rasham Bedat Hakel, Chok El Siganav, to have Lechem Hapanim, God's message to us is food is not merely incidental, it is part of your Shabbat observance. It is kavod, it is oneg, and it is part of the attempt to sanctify the Shabbat as God commands us to do. Therefore, it does not make any sense, if you want to put it like that, to allow fasting on Shabbat. Now, you could broaden this also to the fact that our first introduction as a people to Shabbat was in the context of the mun, the manna which fell during the week for each day, the special rules that on Friday a double portion fell, and it would not spoil if left overnight. In fact, it was supposed to be partially eaten on Friday, and then the rest was supposed to be left over and prepared for Shabbat. That's the nature of Shabbat. Food on Shabbat is not incidental to Shabbat. It is part of the Shabbat observance. And I think that's an appropriate thing to say this Shabbat at the table, when you are fulfilling the mitzvah to eat on Shabbat, and in the context of the Lechem HaPanim and its connection to the whole concept of sanctuary. And remember, if the mitzvah of Lechem HaPanim is tamid, all the time, then it doesn't plug into Shabbat. But the practice of baking the Lechem HaPanim on Friday and on Shabbat ceremonially replacing the previous week's Lechem HaPanim with the new batch, and the old, they say a miracle occurred and it tasted fresh, was eaten by the Kohanim on duty, both the ones outgoing and incoming, in the changing of the guard, so to speak, on that Shabbat. Let's finish on this high note, where we were talking about the Mikdash, which represents sanctity of place. We were talking about Shabbat, which represents sanctity of time. And you really can't say more than that. The Jews' challenge in this world is to sanctify place and time and self. On that note, let me wish you a Chodesh Tov, a Chodesh Sameach, a Shabbat Shalom, and Lehishtamea.
Eitz Chaim hi l'machazikim bo v'samcheha Eitz Chaim hi l'machazikim bo v'samcheha meyushar derachecha darchei noam v'chal nesivoseha shalom derachecha darchei noam v'chal nesivoseha Me'yushar Derachem Yeah.